This News Talk 1010 podcast is brought to you by PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca. Wrongfully dismissed? Changes made to your job? Lowballed on severance? Find out if you have a case before you call a lawyer. Go to PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca.
This is Tim Hudak on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Getting close to Christmas, getting close to crunch time. Vaccines on their way into our great country, but a long way to go. Look, today I'm going to talk a bit about, well, at the end of my show, Christmas trees. A regular Christmas visitor to the Tim Hudak Show here on the iHeartRadio Network. When I'll have the secretary from the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario, the executive director, I should say, on my show. And then highlighting some of the great work by MPPs on news that you may not have heard of at Queen's Park. Sarah Singh, she's a deputy leader of Ontario's New Democrats, has a private member's bill around protecting kids with Down's syndrome before they're born. Those that have had recent pregnancies know you find out if a fetus may have Down syndrome, a lot are aborted. Sarah Singh wants to do something about that. Stay tuned. That's at 5:30. Right off the top, you know, last week I spoke about scarcity and choice. It's the very heart of economics. That was my area of study. And one of the most intriguing and challenging roles of government are always around issues of scarcity. How do you divide up a limited supply of something or time for something? Like organ donations is a classic example. Or the 407, where you pay to ride, but you keep moving faster. Medical school spots, usually decided by grades. Vaccinations is one that we dealt with last week. Another big problem in political debate or decisions that somebody like Premier Ford and his ministers need to make is that balance between personal freedoms and liberties and the public good, particularly issues around safety and health. And a lot of that tends to be now in areas of public health. The right to run your own business, to enjoy life versus lockdowns, mask mandates, and restriction on behavior. That's been a ton of the issues we've talked about these last number of months. So the latest issue, I want to talk about the heavy decisions that leaders have to make, the weight on their shoulders in areas of personal freedoms versus the public good. Is the right not to take the COVID vaccine versus the duty of an employer to protect their employees at all costs? We are obligated to do so to place a healthy workplace. So there's controversy in this area. I used to deal with it in my old job as an MPP, leader of the Ontario PC party, like mandatory flu shots for healthcare workers in hospitals and long-term care homes to protect, well, them, but importantly, patients. There's politics. There's lockdown politics, and now vaccine politics. So let's play round two. Does an employer have a right to mandate a vaccine in their duty to keep a workplace safe? Let's play. You make the call.
The Bell Talk Radio Network presents You Make the Call.
Well, you heard it on the iHeartRadio Network. Needles on their way landing tonight. And we certainly have lots of arms that are going to line up to meet those needles head on. But can you force them to get together? Well, the first batch of vaccines arrive in Canada tonight like Santa Claus. Come early. We're already lined up. We'll be healthcare workers first, frontline workers like police and grocery, and vulnerable populations like seniors and Indigenous people. But here is the looming question for tonight. What happens when the immovable object of personal liberty, the right to decide what you do with your own body, has a collision with the irresistible force of public safety? Employers, like me, are obligated to take measures to ensure the workplace is safe. Employers are now seeking legal advice if they can make the COVID vaccine mandatory for staff and customers who enter the doors. You want back to the office, my friend? Not only have to wear a mask, you gotta get the shot. Mandatory COVID vaccine for workplaces, the right thing for public safety, or is it a violation of your rights? You make the call.
Now, dial 1-877-518-5151. And you make the call.
Quick off the top from Hespel, I work in a food plant. I'm pretty sure they're going to require us to get vaccinated. That could be the case. And I ask Hespler back, text or call me at 877-518-5151. Texas 71010. If the boss at the food plant, my friend Hespler, says you got to get the shot, well, you get the shot. And you think everybody else should get the shot, otherwise they can't come back to the job. The looming question we've taken care of to an extent so far. When the vaccines arrive, who gets them first? You know the list: vulnerable populations, healthcare workers, frontline workers like police, grocery store clerks, indigenous people. Those are the top four. The rest of us line up after that. But the other wave, the next coming wave of big political issues around personal rights and freedoms versus public safety, can employers mandate the vaccine to get you back into the workplace? 877-518-5151 or text me at 71010. A couple off the top. Absolutely not, Tim, says one listener from Toronto. Guelph, violation with three, count them, three exclamation points. No. Another one from Toronto says an employer doesn't have the right to mandate a vaccine or any other medical procedure. If someone isn't vaccinated, the only person they're endangering is themselves. The people who are already vaccinated are protected, says Paul. Well, I appreciate that point, Paul. Love to have some folks call in. 877-518-5151. Text me at 71010. Playing You Make the Call. A big call that the premier will have to make in this province. What kind of workplace options are there when it comes to mandating a vaccine? This is a strong one. I'd rather close a car door on my, well, private parts and get the vaccine. A listener from Ottawa Hall, strong on the no vaccine there, because the other option would be very painful, worth harder than the prick in the arm. All right, another one from Oshawa. Vaccination is a violation of my rights. What's next? Mandating the flu shot. Well, I'm glad that you said that to my friend from Oshawa, because it actually does exist in the province of Ontario. There are mandatory flu shots for healthcare workers in our province. Now, this has gone to the courts. It has been protested. People can get out if they claim a religious or medical exemption. Medical exemption would obviously be some sort of allergic reaction or vulnerability. I'm never really quite sure, and it never was in my time in politics, what the religious exemption would be around getting a flu shot or a vaccine. But it does exist. And it also exists in our schools. Our kids have to have a certain number and types of vaccinations to go into these schools. Yes, they can claim a medical exemption or a religious exemption, whatever that is. But otherwise, it's mandatory. So this does exist. Don't tell me it doesn't exist. It exists in some areas. We've never encountered anything like COVID-19 before. So do you buy it? If you want to go back to your workplace, you want to make sure people you are working with every day have the vaccine, shouldn't your employer have the ability to do so? 877-518-5151 or text me at 71010. So a good article in the CBC about this issue just broke on Friday. Can employers mandate the COVID-19 vaccine? The law is not clear. Posted on December 11th, author John Paul Tasker. And John Paul says, you know what? Most premiers have ruled out compelling all citizens to get a shot. And based on a recent polling, a sizable minority of Canadians, up to 18% of those surveyed, have said they will refuse to be vaccinated. And the provinces aren't looking for a fight to do a mass forced immunization campaign. But in the absence of a provincial decree, some employers are now seeking legal opinions on whether they can demand staff and customers be vaccinated, allowing them back into their workplaces. And it is happening in other countries. All right, let's go to Janice in Ajax. Janice, appreciate you playing You Make the Call. What do you think of this? Why don't we just mandate the vaccines? You want to come back to the office?
Well, I think there's actually a third option people are not really discussing. That option is quite simple. You don't have to mandate your employees to be vaccinated, but you can quite quickly indicate to staff, if there's ever an outbreak, that they are now off if they're not vaccinated until they're either vaccinated and fully immune, or until the outbreak is over and they are off without pay.
And Janice, do you mean an outbreak at the workplace?
At the workplace.
Okay. And would that be a little late, though? Like, if we were going to go to that extreme to say that they would, you know, not get paid, you know, why not just be on the safe side and say you have to have the vaccine from the beginning?
This way here, you're not infringing upon anybody's rights, but at the same time, doing your utmost to protect your staff as well.
And Janice, you plan on getting the vaccine yourself?
150%. I'm a healthcare worker. I cannot wait to get the darn vaccine.
And do you get, is a flu vaccine mandated in your workplace?
No, the flu vaccine is not mandated in my workplace. My workplace literally has the exact policy I was just discussing.
Very good. Janice, really appreciate you playing. You make the call, 877-518-5151. Text me at 71010. Mandatory vaccine in the workplace. Are you for it or are you against it? The law in Ontario is not quite clear. In British Columbia, a BC arbitrator allowed a provincial policy that required healthcare workers in the province be vaccinated or to wear masks during flu season. So that was seen as valid in BC, but a similar case in Ontario. Arbitrators overruled the mandatory flu vaccine policy, saying the employer's failure to secure an order from the provincial medical officer of health was a violation. All right, let's, you know what? I know Dave's on the line. Let's hold on to Dave until after the break, because I want to keep going on this. The mandatory vaccine in the province of Ontario. If your boss said, look, I'd love to have you come back to the office. I want you to keep doing your job, but to protect everybody's health and safety, you got to get the shot. You got to get the COVID-19 vaccine. This is unprecedented times calling for unprecedented measures. Do you buy it or not? It can happen in the States to a degree. I'll tell you in a moment. It's happening in the United Kingdom. My question for you, should it happen in Canada next? We'll continue. You make the call after this. The time is 5:15.
This is Tim Hudak on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
All right, welcome back. Coming up after 5:30, the deputy leader of Ontario's New Democrat, Sarah Singh, will talk about her private member's bill. It hits on a very controversial issue people are afraid to talk about, and that is the abortion of Down syndrome kids. She's trying to help more of those kids to, well, survive and be born. After 5:40, Christmas tree farmers of Ontario. Can't get your tree yet? I'll ask for some tips to rescue you in time for Christmas. All right, we're playing You Make the Call. As I said, there's politics, there's lockdown politics, and now we've got vaccine politics, some of the stickiest issues out there. Where do you draw the line between personal liberty and freedom and the necessity of protecting the public, particularly public health? Should you make vaccines mandatory in the workplace? We got a whole whack of callers lined up for You Make the Call. Let's go to Dave. You're up. Thanks for playing You Make the Call. What do you say?
Hey, Tim. Thanks for taking my call. As far as, you know, policy options when it comes to trying to get people to do what you want them to do in their own self-interest, I mean, I think you can go two directions. Either you punish the behaviors that you don't want, or you have to incentivize the right behaviors in a positive way. And I think in this case, you know, I would hope that the protection from the virus should be reason enough for most people to get the shot. But if not, I think employers need to look at other ways to incentivize that behavior. And maybe this is a punishment at the same time, but I think if people aren't prepared to get the shot, maybe they need to keep wearing a mask going forward and, you know, let that be the incentive or the test, so to speak, for them to decide whether or not it's worth it. And if someone,
that's interesting.
So help so my workplace. Not getting the vaccine, if they're prepared to wear a mask for 8 hours a day, then good on them. But for some, that might be enough to go get it. And, you know, for others, it might be being able to get on an airplane again. Others, it, you know, just being able to travel across the border.
Those are good points. I got to keep moving, pal. Thanks for playing You Make the Call. Dave makes an interesting point there, folks, on the iHeartRadio network, saying, well, there's a trade-off. You get the shot, you don't have to wear the mask around the office. A bit of quid pro quo. There's a one set of rules for those that would get the passport because they got the vaccine in the office, and others would have to, well, keep the old rules, keep the mask, keep their distance until they get the shot. So here's the dice here. I'll go to a few more callers on this. You Make the Call around mandatory vaccines in the workplace for COVID. In Ontario, there's something called the Occupational Health and Safety Act that binds me as an employer. I'm the CEO of the Ontario Real Estate Association. We're a small, medium-sized business in the north part of Toronto. So we have an obligation to get rid of known hazards in the workplace, protect employees from work-related illness or injury. And I tell you, my team, I've got a small number who think they're Superman, that they'll never get COVID or the flu or anything. And I've got another on the other extreme that thinks if they look somebody in the eye, they're going to catch COVID. About 90-some people in the workplace, I got to find the right balance, right, to give them safety and comfort and keep them productive. So I'm obligated as an employer to take precautions to stop the spread of infectious disease in the workplace. So a vaccine requirement would line up with the Occupational Health and Safety Act, but should I make it mandatory? I'm looking for your advice. We do it in our schools. We do it in our hospitals and long-term care for flu. So why not, when it comes to COVID, do it in the workplace? Mario calling in from Toronto. You're playing a You Make the Call. Mandatory shot in the arm, Mario, to get back in the office. You like it or you lump it?
I lump it. And I don't want to come across as some lunatic here or Bible-thumping nut. This is scary.
I'm in suspense, Mario.
It is scary. And I will say that everybody out there in Radio Land has heard of something similar to what I'm going to say in some shape or form, and even seen some Hollywood movies that touch on it.
All right.
Okay, I'm down to earth. I'm quite sane. Where this thing, if you don't attain a certain thing, you won't be able to go to work, you won't be able to do your banking, you won't be able to go buy groceries. Now, isn't this coincidental?
With what?
Isn't it coincidental?
You've got to get the point here, Mario.
Pardon me?
With what? Please get to the point. I'm trying to understand what
the
point here.
Is this. Oh, my God in heaven. I have to spell it out to you. If you don't obtain this, you won't be able to go to the bank. You won't be able to do your banking. You won't be able to go to buy groceries. You won't be able to go to work. You won't be able to do anything. You're stuck.
That's right.
Okay. I'm trying to direct your thoughts to prophetic things.
Okay. The end of the world.
Well,
all right, Mario.
Please don't put it that way.
Okay, I just got to keep going here, pal. I really appreciate playing You Make the Call. Thanks for your point of view about what may be happening here. Thanks, Mario from Toronto. Let's now move on to Leslie calling in from Oakville. Leslie, as You Make the Call, I'm the CEO. I've got a duty to protect my employees, to give them a safe workplace. Shouldn't I say you want to come back to the office? You get the COVID shot.
Well, as it stands, I am actually an employee of a hospital, and I'm going to be faced with that situation pretty soon, in the next couple of weeks, or sooner than that. My obligation is to the public, and I want to see safety. I want to see protection. Is the public going to protect me?
Interesting. So people who come into a hospital should have their shot.
Yes, I agree, and we have seen that this flu the flu has been, you know, there's less of incidences of the flu, as they say on the news, and because people have gone out and gotten the flu shot, me included. Mm-hmm. So why is it not that everybody can protect each other by going for this? This is a risk we are all going to take. Why is it just the healthcare employees, the healthcare workers, are going to have to put themselves on this doubtful line?
Hey, Leslie from Oakville, thank you very much for playing You Make the Call. Leslie makes a really good point there. We've got an unlevel playing field. If the healthcare workers are mandated to have the shot, why can those coming in get off the hook? Should we make it for everybody? This is interesting, too. In the United Kingdom, where they got the shots first, and health authorities have been vaccinating for about a week now, some workplaces, bars, cinemas, restaurants, and concert venues have signaled that they're not going to let patrons in. To Leslie's point, people coming to the hospital, these businesses in the UK will say, you don't have your vaccination slip, you're not coming in to use their business, a vaccine passport. So if some workplaces are doing that for patrons, I bet they're going to do it for employees as well. Well, we'll see where this goes. We'll see how Premier Ford, the medical officer health, David Williams, react to this. Certainly lawyers are also saying that if they make it mandatory, whether it's hotspots or elsewhere, just like masks are mandatory, that will get employers off the hook and eliminate the confusion. What do I think about this? Well, look, it is easier on employers with a province-wide decree. But I think that a number of people are going to say, hey, you make me take the shot? Well, then I'm going to take an accommodation and I'm going to continue to work from home. You're going to continue to pay me. I remain a bit dubious about this, too. The shot was rushed through the process. We'll see it works out. But if I'm going to now force people to take the shot, when I think a lot of folks are saying, I'm going to wait and see how this all works out, doesn't seem right as the employer. I'll encourage it, but I'm not going to demand it. And I'll keep existing safety provisions in place till we get this under a much more controllable level. And certainly, they should make it available widespread. I'll probably line up. I'm just not going to be first in line. All right, coming up next, Sarah Singh of the New Democrats. Her bill to protect kids that aren't quite born yet who have Down syndrome to live a full life. I look forward to that. All right, coming up next, Sarah Singh. Time of the clock, is 527.
The conversation continues with Tim Hudak on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hey, thanks for all the action on that last segment, by the way. I'd say, looking through the text, about two-thirds oppose a mandatory vaccine to get back in the workplace. Although I did hear from a couple of employers that say, yeah, here's one from Ottawa. Yes, for sure, Tim. Not only would it help control the spread, but the money it costs an employer. It's a small workplace I have, and if half the staff are off sick and have to stay home 14 days, I'll just have to close it down and hand the keys to the bank. Thanks for that, Jerry. Another one, and if as an employer, am I liable if a staff or client gets sick? If so, make it mandatory. All right, next up, you know, a little while ago, I hosted this woman as somebody to watch, a new upcoming star in the legislature shortly after she was elected, and Hudak called it right. Sarah Singh was elected as the MPP for the Brampton area. She rose up off the top to become the deputy leader of Ontario's New Democrats in like 2 years or less, and is also the critic for housing. Sarah, by the way, is a multilingual PhD candidate for Ryerson University, unless you finished it, with a Master of Arts in International Development Studies, a long history of local advocacy, being the founding director of Broadening Horizons, board director of Community Living Ontario, and former vice president of the Brampton-Caledon Community Living. Sarah Singh, deputy leader, welcome back to the Tim Hudak Show.
Hi, Tim. Thanks so much for having me back on.
All right, Sarah, just 2 years and a bit on the job. What's the most surprising thing so far as an MPP?
Well, this last session has certainly been a surprise for many of us, but lots of learnings, and I'm really enjoying the journey so far.
Well, you're doing a great job. Congratulations on your success, and I want to talk to you about a bill that caught my eye. I would like to highlight on this show stories that I think take a lot of guts and you may not always hear about in the media. So you brought forward legislation to end bias against Down syndrome pregnancies by ensuring that expected parents receive the most up-to-date, evidence-based written information relating to Down syndrome. That's from your press release. What exactly is the bias you're trying to combat?
Oh, thanks so much. So, you know, Tim, I think for a lot of families, and we heard from families across Ontario, and including my own, you know, when many expectant mothers receive that prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome, it's often billed as a lot of, you know, misinformation, reinforcing a lot of negative stereotypes. And so what we're trying to do is end that so that that discrimination doesn't start before a person's had an opportunity to live out their life. Things have changed over the last 20, 30 years, and we want to make sure that families have the right information to make informed choices.
You know, Debbie and I faced that choice. Debbie's pregnancies were high-risk pregnancies. We had all of the tests. We had the Down syndrome test, and I know some parents then will wrestle if they have a child with Down syndrome. Some choose to abort that child, worried about, I guess, quality of life of the child and the impact on their lives, I think, more importantly. You called this bill, Sarah Singh, Harvey and Gravier's Law. Please tell us why you gave this bill that name.
Yeah, so it's actually named after Harvey and Gravier. So Harvey is Sarah Thompson's younger son, and he was born about 3 years ago. And she had a very negative experience when she received her prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome. You know, she was told that maybe she should consider adoption, and, you know, that her options would be very limited with Harvey. And, you know, that was the exact same experience that my mom had when she had my sister Gravier in 1991. So Sarah and I got together, you know, to ensure that we tried to do everything we could to stop that. And that's why the bill is named after both Harvey and Gravier.
And how bad is the problem, sir? I mean, how often when a woman or a couple understand that they're pregnant, that they're expecting a child with a high likelihood of Down syndrome, how much more likely is that child to be aborted than not?
Well, I think, you know, for us, this is about making sure that people have access to information and so that they can make the right decision for their family. It isn't to say what that decision should or should not be. But that's what we were finding, was that a lot of families weren't receiving up-to-date, accurate medical information. And often they were being told that their child's life expectancy was going to be limited. And I think based on that information, you know, sometimes families were forced into making a decision that they may not have made had they been given the right information up front. So, you know, we hope that with this bill, by giving and empowering families with information, they can make informed decisions that they need to.
I'm speaking with Sarah Singh. Sarah is the MPP for Brampton Centre. She's a deputy leader of Ontario's New Democratic Party. She has a private member's bill to try to discourage the abortion of kids with Down syndrome and to focus on the extraordinary quality of life they can have and bring to their family. So, Sarah, I was also moved because this is a personal issue for you and your family, as you mentioned earlier. So tell me a bit about Gurveer.
Yeah, no, and Tim, just want to make sure that we clarify, this isn't to discourage anyone from making a choice. You know, families have to do what's right for them, and we really want to encourage people to be empowered with information. So, you know, if at the end of the day a person decides that they would like to access reproductive health options that they feel are appropriate for their family, we want to make sure that they can do that as well. And so this bill is really about informing and providing information to community members and through the medical profession. But, you know, often we are finding that because people don't have that information, they are making choices that are probably maybe not best for them and their family. And that was exactly the experience that, again, both my mom and Harvey's mom had, was that they received information and thankfully they were able to still make a decision that was right for them and learn that, you know, despite the discrimination and stereotypes that they were told about having a child with Down syndrome, that their experience was quite the opposite. I mean, Harvey is a very healthy and happy young boy, and my sister Gurveer, you know, she contributes to our local community through creating art, and she's an entrepreneur. But again, if maybe my parents had made a different decision or Harvey's mom had made a different decision, we wouldn't get to experience the gifts that both these individuals contribute to our local community.
And tell me a bit about Gurveer. You said she's an entrepreneur. Tell me a little bit about what she does in that area. I always admire people who have that kind of spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. So she has created a collection of artwork, and we actually have created postcards that we are selling and helping to facilitate local art projects. But she is one of the founding members of our nonprofit organization as well, and has helped us contribute to local art projects. And she's just recently started to work on a collection of skincare products, all natural skincare products, actually. So we're helping her figure out ways to kind of bring that to the community in the next little while.
Yeah, hopefully a good Christmas season for her too with a couple weeks to go. Sarah, you mentioned another Sarah Valiquette Thompson. She's a co-founder of Perfectly Me, and if I understood, the mom of Harvey, for whom the bill is also named along with Gurveer. Tell me a bit about Perfectly Me.
So Perfectly Me was founded by Sarah Valiquette Thompson out of her experience of trying to help other families, you know, understand their diagnosis, understand that there are resources and that folks are not alone. You know, that there is an entire community of people with children who have Down syndrome and who've had similar experiences. So this is about celebrating those differences, acknowledging that even if you've got an extra chromosome, you're still perfect the way you are, and that's really what Perfectly Me is all about.
And Sarah, your bill, again, 225, and it's called Harvey and Gurveer's Law, has a cooling off period in it. Can you describe exactly what that would mean?
So the proposed legislation would allow for families to have some time to understand the diagnosis, to have access to information, perhaps community resources that they may currently not have. Often when families are given that prenatal diagnosis, there isn't a time for them to understand the information, to look for appropriate resources. And so what we're proposing is that there is some time, 48 hours, for families to understand that diagnosis, seek out additional medical information before making any decisions that they feel may be right for their family.
Sarah Singh, MPP, Brampton Centre, Deputy Leader of Ontario's New Democrats, thank you for your courage in bringing forward this important bill and highlighting the amazing lives that kids with Down syndrome will have and with their families. Thank you for your leadership.
Thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat about it. And happy holidays to all the viewers, the listeners today.
Thank you very much, and the best to yourself, too. Thanks for your work there in Brampton Centre as well. All right, coming up next, a regular guest on the Tim Hudak Show, the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario. So looking for a tree? Hey, maybe we can get you a little tree action still. And I'm going to ask, what is the best Christmas tree to have after all? Because we had that debate within our own home. The time of the clock is now 5:41.
This is Tim Hudak on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
So we got out this... well, last weekend to get our Christmas tree, which we almost always get from the Beamsville Lions. They do a great job for the community in Western Niagara. And man, the pickings were super slim. They were gone 3-4 weeks before Christmas. So we went down Highway 8 and we went to Butterballs, and they had a nice one. It wasn't our usual, but we got the Scotch Pine. Did I make the right call on the Christmas tree? Well, who better to ask than the expert on Christmas trees in our great province of Ontario, Shirley Brennan. Shirley is the executive director of the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario. Shirley, welcome back to the Tim Hudak Show.
Thanks for having me again, Tim.
Oh, it's always a lot of fun, Shirley. Early Merry Christmas. You've always got a lot of Christmas cheer in your voice.
Thank you. Tell
us a bit about the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario.
So the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario, I represent 124 Christmas tree farms all across Ontario. This year we had some challenges with our pandemic going on, but otherwise we are having a fabulous season.
Christmas trees can get COVID?
No, Christmas trees can't, so that's good. I did have some questions on that, but yeah. We did have to put some protocols in place. So, but it's amazing. I did have a few phone calls to my office about whether or not COVID can live on Christmas trees.
Oh, God, you never know. You never know. Oh, my gosh, that's awesome. So what? So Debbie and I and the girls went for our mm-hmm. usual spot, get our usual tree, and my God, they were already on their second batch, and there was like four trees left. They're all this Charlie Brown trees that were left. So what's going on with, is there a tree shortage?
Well, first off, a Charlie Brown tree in your eyes is somebody's perfect tree
okay.
in their eyes. But yes, so what's happening is, we are seeing the demand rise, and we've been seeing that. Like our talk last year was the same thing, right? We have been seeing a 15% per year increase of demand, and that goes for a lot of reasons. You know, a lot of young people are getting in the housing market. We're seeing urban sprawl all over the place. They want to come out and get their start their own traditions and get their real tree. So we certainly are seeing a lot of that. We're seeing a lot of new people that have never had trees before come out this year, and we're also seeing just the demand right across North America is up for the last 2 years plus. You know, we're going to see this for a couple of years.
More people staying home, snowbirds not yep. going south, I imagine, yep. pushing the tree yep. demand up. So we're lucky. We went down the highway. We got a tree. We usually get firs, but this one we got Scotch Pine. But if you're out there, you're still looking for a good tree, Shirley, what can you do with, you know, 2.5 weeks to go?
Okay, so you did the perfect thing, right? You went outside of your comfort zone. So if, and that's what we're finding, it's the fir trees or the Fraser fir, for instance, that seems to be the huge demand. So there are other options out there. So getting out of your comfort zone, and you went from a fir tree to a Scotch pine, which is huge difference. And as long as you take care of it, you're going to have a tree right through to the season. So be open-minded. You may not be able to get that 9-foot tree, but a lot of places don't need. They only have 8-foot ceilings, and so a 9-foot tree they're cutting down anyway. So certainly look around. I have farms out there in Ontario. Yes, some have closed, but I have some that they update me every Sunday night, and who's open and who still has trees. Some are still letting you cut out of their fields, and some just have pre-cuts available.
And is there a way to search it out? I mean, do the Christmas tree farmers have a site if you want to go cut your yep. own or find a lot?
Yep. If you go to www.christmastrees.on.ca, you certainly will see every Christmas tree farm in Ontario that is a member of our association.
All right. Well, I got to tell you, hopefully you're not a Scotch pine person, because you know what? I don't like it as much. It doesn't have the scent. And now it hurts a little bit. My daughter, Maitland, God bless her, she's a 6-year-old. She actually put on her winter gloves to put up ornaments because she was tired of getting pricked by the Scotch pine. We are a fir family. So you're the expert, Shirley. You know trees from trees.
Yep.
What's in the top two on your list for the best Christmas tree for home?
Okay, so again, it's always in the eye of the beholder, because there's a lot of people out there that are listening that love Scotch pine. So I like spruce trees, but again, it's the same thing. You have to put your gloves on to be able to put your ornaments on, because they do have sharper needles. The fir trees are the ones that everyone wants. They are soft needles. They retain their needles the best. Having said that, if you don't maintain your tree and take care of it by watering it every day, it doesn't matter what tree you have, your needles are going to drop. So, but people like the fir tree for that reason, and you've just said it the same thing. You guys are a fir tree family now because it's softer needles. And that's going to, your kids are going to take that forward. They're going to think, okay, we had this. We don't want that tree ever again. You know, these are the trees we're always going to want. But we, like I said, we've got lots of trees in Ontario. It's just getting out of your comfort zone. And I'm glad to hear, not that you couldn't get the tree that you normally have, but that you went out of that comfort zone and you were able to still have a real Christmas tree.
Yeah, we got a 9-footer and it's pretty, right? It's wow. A full tree. Yep. It looks really good. It's yep. It's not our usual balsam or That's Douglas right. fir, but yeah, I'm happy with it. You know what? Can I tell you a quick story?
Yeah.
I'm a kind of a minor tree farmer. I've got the managed forest tax credit of a tree farmer. We had some eastern pines. So for a couple of years, we went to like cut down our own tree and then the girls thought it was too much. And now they're bigger. I couldn't stop them from growing either. So now I go out and buy them.
Yes, and you know what? That is part of my message this year. It is an amazing industry to be in, but it does take work. So if there's any young people out there that want to go into farming, look at tree farming because it's a great industry to be in.
Okay, let's go down that path. So if you wanted to become a Christmas tree farmer, how many acres would you need? What would you need sort of for starters?
Some of our farms have as little as 5 acres to put trees on, and some go up to 40 acres, right? Because you don't plant it all at once. Usually, most people will plant 500 to 1,000 trees a year so that you have a game plan. Because if you plant them all at once, they're going to be ready all at once or in a couple of years apart. And then you're going to have to wait again. So you plant sections of your property. So if I had 5 acres, I might only plant an acre, which is about anywhere between 700 and 1,000 trees a year. And then I would always have a harvest going on when my 10 years came up. And then, you know, like I said, a lot of the farms have between 10 and 15 acres.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I planted all mine at once. And now if I try to bring them to the house, it'd be like that scene from Vacation with Chevy Chase. They're a little too big. We know all about the firs we walk through and the Scots pine and such. Is there a different kind of tree that's maybe catching on? We're growing more of Ontario if I want to try something different next year.
There isn't because it just seems like, so what happens is there's a lot of farms that, like you may be aware, most Christmas tree farms are on marginal land. So there's a lot of farms that can't grow ones like fir trees, for instance. So they grow the pines and the spruce, and then they have to bring in the fir trees. So you certainly have to watch out who's able to grow fir, and then the wholesalers usually are able to grow those. And those are usually the ones you see for the Lions Club, for instance, or they will bring them in to big box stores and that sort of thing. But there is trees. We're always working with the consumer. So we have tabletop trees, for instance. They come with their own stand. You put them on a table. They're a fir tree, a small fir tree. And
nice.
We're seeing more and more of those. Because the older generation are moving into condos and apartments that they don't need a huge tree, but they still want to have the real tree.
Love it. Good for you and innovating like that. Shirley, I'm speaking with Shirley Brennan, by the way. Shirley is the executive director of the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario. You can learn a lot more, by the way, about the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario, including doing your own by visiting them at christmastrees.on.ca. Shirley, Christmas trees, also natural trees, are a good environmental solution. Tell us why you make that case.
Well, it's 100% biodegradable. So that's the first point right there. They sink carbon and they produce oxygen. But we also have programs and we work with various streams and river organizations to have ecological habitat, to help with soil erosion, to the parks that you see in your local communities, mulch trees, trees and that sort of thing. And so a lot of areas will have a recycling program, And in some cases, you can get it free. The cities may use them, or they may sell them back to the community or give them back to the community. I know in the Caledon area, at one point, they used to mulch it up, and you used to be able to buy it from I believe it was the Lions Club, but I know it was a charitable organization, and that money stayed into the organization. So there's lots of different programs out there for the trees to be recycled afterwards.
Outstanding. Shirley Brennan, Executive Director from the Christmas Tree Farmers of Ontario. Merry Christmas to you, to your tree farmers across the province. Thanks for bringing Christmas cheer to millions of Ontario homes year after year. All right, folks, that's it. That's all. Time for Dinner with Miller and Maitland. I want to thank Joy Roselli, Mike Catherwood, my guests. You just heard her, Shirley Brennan from the Christmas Tree Farmers, and Sarah Singh, Deputy Leader of Ontario's New Democrats. I've said my piece. Until next Sunday, it's 5:57.
This News Talk 1010 podcast was brought to you by PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca. Wrongfully dismissed? Changes made to your job? Lowballed on severance? Find out if you have a case before you call a lawyer. Go to PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca.